As you can see, I have some suggested problems from this chapter. I will be going back and filling in the suggested problems for other chapters as well for the syllabus, but since you have a quiz on Monday, I figured giving you some more concrete suggestions on what to work on might be a good idea. Now, I don't necessarily expect that you're going to get through all of these problems over the weekend. These are problems for both buffer solutions and for solubility, KSP, which is the later half of the chapter, which we have discussed some, but we've got lots more in that section to discuss. I am going to give you an idea as we go through the lecture today what types of things I would be asking you about on the quiz. But at least if you have the time to get going on all of Chapter 19, then you do have an assortment of problems for you to work on. Some of them are repetitive, so particularly like where you have those stretches there where I say do problems 11 through 20. Well, maybe after the first two, you're fine with that problem, and you can skip the other ones that are related to it. That's one nice thing about this text in that the problems are related by type of problem, so that there's clumps of problems that reinforce that same examples form of problem. So if you get through a few of them and you're fine, skip to some of the other types of problems. If you're doing some of these and you run into really big difficulties and you see there are more similar ones, well, feel free to do more of the problems. But this gives you a good idea of some of the types of things that you have to worry about. What I did want to talk about first in terms of content today was about buffers. I unintentionally ended up with a sort of stream of consciousness lecture on Wednesday where all these different ideas about buffers and titrations kind of came out. And yeah, I might have touched on a lot of the important topics, but it wasn't necessarily the organization I would have preferred. So I'd like to recover some of those topics today, and I would like to do a very specific example that's in your text here of how to prepare a buffer of a particular kind. So let's review what buffer solutions are, why they work the way they do, what equation we use when describing buffer solutions, when that equation won't work, and then let's use that equation to come up with a specific buffer solution like this problem that I'd like to do from the text. Before I begin, though, does anybody have any specific questions about any of the content that you've been reading? Because, of course, having that fortunate chance to delay the quiz till Monday, you all took advantage of that and read the chapter, I'm sure, and are all prepared today for lecture, right? Yes.
Is quiz 2 everything after quiz 1 or exam 1?
It is everything after exam 1. Question was, is quiz 2 after quiz 1 or exam 1? After exam 1. So it's mostly going to be what we've been talking about this week with buffer solutions. We did miss Monday, but we got a lot in on Wednesday. Any other questions before we review buffers? Okay, so what is a buffer solution? Okay, that's what it does, but what is a buffer solution? What is the makeup, the composition of a buffer solution? Yes, it is. It is a mixture of an acid and its conjugate base, or if you prefer to think of it that way, a base and its conjugate acid. Acetic acid and acetate has been the example that we've been using so far. The example that we'll use from the textbook today involves carbonate, which is an interesting example because carbonate comes from carbonic acid, which is a diprotic acid. So it is going to allow us to talk a little bit more about acids and their conjugates. So a buffer solution is a solution that contains an acid and its conjugate. Both of them usually weak. What does a buffer solution do? That we got the answer to already, but let's get that answer again. So what is it that it does? So it maintains pH under what conditions? What can you do to a buffer solution? What can you add to it that it resists? A strong acid or a strong base. So we have a system of a weak acid and weak base that combined are able to resist the influence of an externally added strong acid or strong base. So it resists changes in pH. When small quantities of a strong acid or strong base are added. Why does a buffer solution resist changes in pH? That's true, and that's a follow-up question, is where is the best pH for a buffer solution? So we'll come back to that one. Why is it able to then resist the changes? Let's say if we're at that ideal 50-50 mix of an acid and its conjugate. Why?
Because it's towards the end of its logarithmic function.
It's what, I'm sorry? Okay, something related to that, you maybe indirectly. It has to do with the fact that you have a weak acid and its weak conjugate base. If you have something like acetic acid, if you add a little bit of hydroxide to it, yes, you're going to get it to dissociate. But then there's an equilibrium that gets reestablished because acetic acid is a weak acid. Yes, maybe hydroxide can force that acid to dissociate, but the acid will pull back and actually pull some hydrogen off of hydroxide. If we carry that to the extreme, where we completely neutralize acetic acid, we put an equal number of moles of hydroxide in for that amount of acetic acid, well, you're going to end up with a salt in theory, but that salt itself is basic and will actually go back to trying to be acetic acid. So the same could be true about acetic acid or acetate. Just then I was talking about the product you get from neutralization. If you start out with a completely empty solution, just plain water, and you throw sodium acetate in, the solution's going to be basic because that salt wants to establish an equilibrium. If you have both the acid and the base sitting there in solution in equilibrium, then if you only add a little bit of strong acid or base, you only neutralize a little bit of one of these two components, which are still trying to maintain an equilibrium. So as long as you don't completely consume up the conjugate acid or conjugate base, they keep on trying to establish this equilibrium, which is why it doesn't shift very much. Now, as soon as you do add a bunch of the strong acid or the strong base, you're beyond what's called the capacity of that buffer solution, and then the pH is going to start to change rapidly. But within that area, that, as was pointed out, the best area is when you do have equal moles of the acid and its conjugate. Because they're maintaining this equilibrium, that's why the pH doesn't change very much. Now there's a question. That's pretty much it. If you have hydrochloric acid that you completely neutralize, you make sodium chloride, which is not an acid or a base. It doesn't do anything to prevent that shift in pH. But it's when you have a weak acid that then when it dissociates also makes a weak base, the two are fighting with each other for the H plus in solution. And it's that equilibrium that maintains then that pH. But if you consume too much of one of the two components, then your pH starts to change rapidly. Does that make sense? So, why does a buffer solution resist changes in pH? because of the equilibrium established by the acid-base conjugate pair. How much acid or base can the buffer resist? What is it going to depend on? How much of that pair there is, right? That's what's known as the buffer capacity. So it depends on the quantity of the acid-base conjugate pair. What is an ideal buffer solution and its pH? So what is an ideal buffer solution composition? And the resulting pH. Well, that was mentioned quite a bit earlier, that it's when you have equal moles of the acid and the conjugate. And then what about the pH part? No, only 7 if we want a buffer that's pH 7. But a buffer could be prepared at a variety of pHs, depending on what our pair is that we use. So an indirect way of asking the same question is, how do we choose what compounds to use to make a buffer solution? So you know the pH that you want, but what other quantity then, related to that acid-base pair, do you use to choose the right acid and base? The Ka. Because remember that when you have equal quantities of its acid and its conjugate, the pH is equal to the pKa of the weak acid. Now, this is where Wednesday's lecture really came in. We talked an awful lot about titration and pH changes. And I started out with something that was more review, you could say. Why does the shape of a titration curve look the way it does? And so we talked about a log scale. And from that, we got the equivalence point. From that, we then went on this discussion about the half equivalence point. And so without trying to repeat that whole lecture, let's just come up with an example. And since I've got the textbook, let me do something besides acetic acid for once. Let me just look up a new number for me to memorize. Oh, let's see. How about formic acid? Formic acid has a Ka of 1.8 times 10 to the negative 4. It has the formula HCOOH. It is also a carboxylic acid, just like acetic acid. If I wanted to expand this out a little bit, I could write its structure. So this COOH group, that's called a functional group. That's the carboxylic acid group. Have any of you ever heard the term functional group before? Some of you have. That might have come from an organic review, or maybe when you did the acid-base lab back in 1A, someone identified this for you. This is called a carboxylic acid. And I won't get into functional groups at the moment, but what they are a pattern of atoms that have the same reactivity no matter what molecule they show up on. So this formic acid is an acid because of this COOH group. Acetic acid is an acid because of it. Oxalic acid, propanoic acid, butanoic, all these other biological acids all have the same COOH group. Just as another little bit of side knowledge, formic is related to formica, the Latin word for ant. And the reason it's called formic acid is because this is the one of the components that's in some forms of the stingy stuff that's in the venom of ants that sting. What if we have a solution that is equal concentration of formic acid and its conjugate? Calculate the pH. Now, there's the long way, which we reviewed. Let's start the long way again, and then we're going to not finish it. The long way is we identify the things that are in equilibrium in solution. So we have an acid. We have its conjugate. And the difference between the two is H+. So the three things that we have in equilibrium are the acid, the conjugate, and H+. There's a Ka expression we can write for that, which would be H+ times the concentration of formate over the concentration of formic acid. H plus times A minus over HA. That is equal to the 1.8 times 10 to the negative 4. What we have to do, though, is come up with the equilibrium concentrations of these things if we're going to try to solve for pH. And so what we had done before is to take formic acid and formate and H+, we talk about what it's going to start at for its concentration and how it's going to change and therefore what the end concentrations are going to be. And we have 0.5 and 0.5 at the beginning because what we do is we pretend. We pretend that somehow those things have not undergone their dissociation yet. And so when we say 0.5, there really is 0.5. But let me squeeze this in on the next page then. It's a small statement, but an important one. The given concentrations of the reagents do not really exist in solution. Because the two reagents will try to establish an equilibrium. That's why we're going through this ice problem. And maybe it's something obvious, but maybe it's not. That's why I'm pointing it out. You're given 0.5 and 0.5, and they're not real numbers. They're real numbers in the sense that we could have taken a bottle of formic acid, measured out a certain number of moles, tossed it into water, and we come up with its concentration. But we could stop right there because it's going to dissociate once it hits water. So even if you measured out the number of moles, put it in water, you don't have that many moles because it's dissociated. The same thing is true with the formate, the conjugate, that if you had it as a salt, measured out as a powder, put it on the balance, got its exact number of moles, that's all fine, but as soon as you put it in the water, some of it turns into formic acid. So when you have both of the things that you throw into solution at once, they both are going to adjust a little bit. And that's the key to how we handle buffer solutions. And let me fill out a little more of the math to come back exactly to that point. We're going to continue to assume that the H plus concentration initially is zero, because although we have weak acids and weak bases that we're dealing with, we're assuming they're not so weak that they won't dissociate at all. In other words, looking at that 10 to the negative 4th Ka value for formic acid, I can guesstimate that that's going to have a pH of about 2-ish in solution if we were to solve a problem for just formic acid itself. pH 2 means 10 to the negative 2 concentration, which is big, but not as big as 0.5. So in other words, that's the wrong thing to compare to. 10 to negative 2 is huge compared to the autoionization of water. That's the point I'm making. So in other words, we'll ignore it here. Now we say minus X because some of the acid's going to dissociate. We say plus X over here because if the acid dissociates, it has to make the conjugate. And of course, there's also the H plus that's kicked off in that process. So we get 0.5 minus X, 0.5 plus X, and plus X, which we could stick into the Ka expression and solve a quadratic. And what we'll find out, though, is that X is a lot smaller than the concentration of the reagents. So let's finish the sentence. The given concentrations of the reagents do not really exist in solution because the two reagents will try to establish an equilibrium. However, in a weak acid base conjugate system, the changes in concentration are often small enough that they can be ignored. And I'm going to duck the question one more time, just for the moment, of specifically how do we know when this is allowable? Because let's just focus on what buffer solutions are later, or now, and then get into technicalities later. So what's the point of this last statement? Well, if X is much less than the 0.5 molar concentration that we have of those materials, then 0.5 minus X is equal to 0.5, which is equal to 0.5 plus X. I think that part of the math I'd done the other day, where I said that X just becomes zero. What does that mean? That means we can use that Ka expression directly. And we can put in our 0.5 concentration, which cancels out now, because it's the same concentration on the top and the bottom. And that means that we get the Ka is equal to the H plus concentration, so the pKa is equal to the pH, which, since we've gotten this far, let me find the real value. Given that the Ka of formic acid is 1.8 times 10 to the negative 4, then I get a pH of 3.75. Great. Now, what if I don't have exactly equal quantities of those two things? Well, if that change in concentration when equilibrium is established is still small, well, maybe if I had 0.4 moles and 0.6 moles, that I'm still going to be in a situation where I can ignore that plus and minus x. In other words, I can use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. When the changes in concentration due to establishing equilibrium can be ignored, the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation can be used. It's a general form of exactly this little bit of math I did here. Earlier, I was trying to get to this magic condition of pKa equaling pH, which that, again, was something that came up in Wednesday's lecture. We talked about titration curves and how this point corresponds to the half equivalence point, because half equivalence is when you have equal moles of an acid and a conjugate. But not to get lost in all that again, let me just show you the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. And I showed how we derived it on Wednesday. And I did talk about when it's allowable to be used, but today I focused more on buffers, less on titration. Maybe as a review for the quiz, I'll come back and talk about what you need to know about titration. But I would think we would hopefully all agree that we've got a little bit more concrete map about buffer solutions based on the discussion we've had so far today. At least that's my hope. Do we feel maybe a little more confident about buffer solutions today than you did Wednesday? Would we like to still work that example problem, though, so you can see something specific you need to be able to do? Yes. Given that your instructor has a habit of putting on the quiz exactly what it is talked about in lecture, what do you think the probability of this type of problem would be to show up on your quiz? Pretty darn high, right? What is the problem? From page 835 in your text, you're given this situation. An environmental chemist needs a carbonate buffer solution of pH 10.00. That's one of our targets. To study the effects of acid rain on limestone-rich soils. How many grams, that's the what do you have to answer part, how many grams of sodium carbonate must be added to 1.5 liters of a 0.20 molar sodium bicarbonate solution to make the buffer? This is a specific type of buffer problem where you're given most of the information. You are given all the information to be able to solve for this buffer. If you're not given something like what's shown here, a specific quantity of a specific concentration of solution, then there's an infinite number of answers. Because maybe you only have a 0.1 molar solution that you choose to make, or 0.2 or 0.25. In other words, there's infinite flexibility depending on what your buffer capacity is. But because we have this volume and concentration, that establishes the capacity for you. You know how much of one of the components you need. It's just asking then, how much of that other component do you need? So, how do we solve this problem? Well, there is one more piece of information that we need here. And before I give it to you, I want to show you something about carbonic acid. First, because I do like you knowing what the structures of these compounds are. Let me write out the structure of carbonic acid. Carbonic acid is, again, a carboxylic acid because it has the COOH group. It's a little bit more unusual because it's like it's two carboxylic acids fused into one. And that is related to the fact that that will dissociate twice. So you can have carbonic acid that will dissociate to make H+ and hydrogen carbonate, which will also dissociate again to make the carbonate ion. That's, of course, assuming that carbonic acid doesn't just decompose, because what will carbonic acid turn into spontaneously? CO2 and water, which is why soft drinks are fizzy, because it has carbonic acid dissolved in it, which decomposes, which is what gives you the bubbles. There are two Ka values. One that governs the dissociation of carbonic acid, and then there's one dissociation that's for hydrogen carbonate. Recall, by the way, that hydrogen carbonate is the more formal name for bicarbonate. They're the same thing. Which of these two pKa values do we need for this problem? Ka2. Ooh, I heard a 1 out there. But why not Ka1? Because it is the second acid and its conjugate that are the subject of this problem. Ka2 governs the relationship between bicarbonate and carbonate, where Ka1 governs the relationship between carbonic acid and bicarbonate. So since hydrogen carbonate and carbonate are involved in this problem, Ka2 is used, not Ka1. Ka2, the book tells you, is equal to 4.7 times 10 to the negative 11. Now we have all the information we need, because we're going to use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. Henderson-Hasselbalch equation is pH is equal to pKa plus base 10 log of A minus concentration over HA. We have the Ka, so we just take the negative log to get the pKa, which, since it's here, I will save us time and cheat and copy it down. So pKa2, the negative base 10 log of Ka, is equal to 10.33. So let's substitute that into the equation. We want a buffer that's pH 10. We have a acid-base pair that, if it was an ideal buffer, if we had equal moles of the acid and base, then that pH, which is the same as the pKa at that point, is 10.33. Then what do we throw in? Well, we can solve for the rest of this, that it's the log of A minus over HA. So moving this around, we get the log of A minus over HA is equal to negative 0.33. And then that means that that ratio itself, A minus over HA, is equal 10 to the negative 0.33, which is 0.47. Now, look at that last statement, and remember what I said earlier, that if I didn't give you enough information, there's an infinite number of solutions. And here's why. Because all that depends on getting the right pH is having this ratio of the acid and its conjugate. If we didn't know how much one of either of those two things that we start with, then we have any option we want to, well, that makes physical sense, as far as what we want to put in there. There is no such thing as a million molar solution that's going to be possible. So, okay, it's not totally infinite. But we do know the concentration of one of these things, don't we? Because it starts out in the problem saying that we have 1.5 liters of 0.2 molar sodium bicarbonate. So that is the numerator in this expression. Now it looks like that it solves. No, it solves it exactly that way. So the concentration of HA bicarbonate, which is what we've given, is HA. We need to solve for A minus then. A minus is equal to 0.47 times HA. But we need moles of A minus, which is going to be 0.47 times the moles of HA, which we can calculate by taking the 1.5 liters of bicarbonate and multiply it by the 0.2 molar concentration. And that ends up being 0.14 moles of carbonate. If we now multiply by the molar mass of sodium carbonate, we have our grams needed. Buffer solution problems of this kind all involve the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. The work you have to do is to interpret the word problem. And I'll review what I did for this particular problem again to show what we have to calculate. We have the target pH. We already know the acid-base conjugate pair, so we already know the pKa value that we're supposed to be using. In the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, the only two other variables are the acid concentration and the conjugate base concentration. The problem gives you the acid concentration. So that means we have three of the variables and simply need to solve for the fourth. So if you just looked at it as a math problem, it's probably easy. But understanding what a buffer solution is and how one forms and how it operates, that can get you bogged down a little bit. But that's what we work through in the problem. The rest of it is just math. Questions about this problem? Yes. The question was, the Ka for this acid is pretty close to the Kw. Do we have to worry about autoionization? No. Even in problems where maybe we should, we're usually not going to. That's something that we would do more in a physical chemistry class, third year chemistry. Maybe we could do it here, but I'll put it this way. I'm not planning to do it because we got plenty more important concepts to work on. Other questions about this problem? So the first part of the notes from today, that's related to what buffer solutions are. The rest of the notes so far today are on how to work a buffer problem. Let me go back to Wednesday now and talk about what you need to know about titration curves. If or when I ask you about a titration curve on the quiz, it's going to be the same type of titration that we've already discussed, which would be a weak acid, strong base. We already discussed why it is that the pH changes most rapidly here at the equivalence point. In lab, we've already talked about the difference between the equivalence point and the end point, which happens to be one of the problems I assigned from the chapter to discuss that difference. So, as a reminder, how is this different from the end point? You should still be able to answer that. Now, maybe that's something I would throw in a lab quiz instead. Maybe it would be on a lecture quiz, because it's really a material appropriate to both. Of course, since this is just a quiz, I'm not going to ask everything possible. So, but don't worry, if you spend time studying something and it's not on the quiz, it always has the chance to be on the exam, so you didn't waste your time studying. Now back to the curve. If this is the equivalence point, it's minus 5 for Dr. Gray, not putting his axes in. pH is going to be our y-axis, and generally it's going to be the volume of that base that's added that's going to be our x-axis. Once you find the equivalence point, you can find out that volume. I'll call it volume equiv. If we then go to one-half that volume and look at what the pH is there, that is where the pH equals the pKa. That is the half equivalence point. And that's where the acid concentration is equal to its, or approximately equal to, its conjugate base concentration. And in buffer systems where that little bit of adjustment that happens to reach equilibrium, when we can make the same simplifications that we do to use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, well, that's when this statement really is just equal, and it's true. So that's the anatomy of a titration curve that you need to know. Let's mark this up with just a little bit more info. And let me redraw it so it's not too cluttered. We have the equivalence point. We have the half equivalence point. The only other main thing I would put on here is the buffer range. And I think I might have already said that the pH, the ideal pH of that buffer range, is equal to the pKa of that acid plus or minus 1. So this was pretty much the discussion from Wednesday. Wednesday with a lot more mathematical detail reviewing past concepts. This is what you need to know for the quiz. There's one last thing related to the indicator. We already talked about in lab what an indicator is, but how would we choose the right indicator for titration? Well, the pH at which an indicator normally changes color is equal to the pKa of the indicator. So the pKa of the indicator is not going to be the same as the pKa of your acid. What it is the equivalence point of the indicator should ideally occur the half equivalence point of the indicator should ideally occur at the equivalence point of the titration. That half in front there is really important because it's when we have half equivalence that pH is equal to pKa. That's when we have half of the acid and half of it as the conjugate base. Indicators work because one form is one color, the acid, and its conjugate is another form. So when you pass that 50-50 mark, that's when you change colors. So that 50-50 mark is the half equivalence point for the indicator. That indicator is being thrown in, though, to visualize another titration. And that titration has its equivalence point, where you want to be able to find that point. So you make the indicator change colors at the equivalence point. And so to do that, you figure out that pH and make that the half equivalence for the indicator. The quiz is not going to have anything to do with KSP or solubility on it. We did some work in that area before the exam, but there's more specific topics in that section I want to cover before I hammer you with questions on it. So what's on this lecture here and what's on the lecture from Wednesday, that is what's going to be on the quiz.